Right now it is time for the Food Maven, Arthur Schwartz. Arthur joins us on a Monday morning, and we always take a look into the wild world of food. Not wild, the wide world of food. Good morning, Arthur.
It's better, yeah. Well, it is fall. Yes. How do we know it's fall? Malamars are back in the supermarket. There's some other reasons we know. But anyway, the Malamars are back. If you don't know what that is or means, it's because they're chocolate-covered marshmallow and I guess it's like a graham cracker base.
Yeah.
Cookie, right?
Yeah.
In fact, I described it yesterday to somebody as s'mores. It's a kind of it's not a heated s'more. And then they said, "Well, can you toast it?" I said, "You could, but they're totally coated in chocolate." And the whole thing is, I guess it's Nabisco who makes Malamars doesn't want them to melt in the stores in the summer. This is, of course, dates back to the days before supermarkets were so well air conditioned that we have to bring a coat with us to go grocery shopping. But anyway. Malamars are back. Last year, I haven't actually checked out my most normal supermarket yet, but last year my most normal supermarket literally had a wall of Malamars. You could not miss it as you walked in the store. But, you know, it's Jewish New Year. It's Rosh Hashanah starting on Sunday night, plus September means going back to school. There are so many reasons, like September to me always feels like New Year. I don't know about you.
No.
It
feels like winter to me, even though it's not.
I love this weather.
Even
if it rains.
I don't mind the weather, but it's just a reminder to me that the real nice, real nice weather's over.
To me, the really bad weather is over.
That's right.
August is my least favorite month.
That's right.
So I'm happy it's. Now it's the middle of September, closing in on the end of September.
Yeah.
I'm happy. I mean, even though I think it's going to be pretty warm and humid today, I still have on my shopping list a flanken to make beef broth. I did this the other day. I bought some flanken to do something else with it, and then I decided, it's easier. Let me just throw it in a pot with some water and vegetables. It was so delicious that now I'm going to use flanken as a base for broth. It's an expensive cut of meat to just make broth. But after you cook it for 2 hours, it's sensational all on its own, and you have the broth. So, and I also have on my shopping list chicken backs to make chicken broth. So I'm really very optimistic here that I'm going to be able to keep the stove on for half a day. Anyway, brisket is the cut of meat that I get asked most about in my life, not just lately, but this time of year, in my life. In fact, the one time I was on the Martha Stewart program on TV, she asked me to make a brisket. And it was, in fact, one of the best briskets of my life, and certainly it was the best brisket of her life, which even now, if I met her, I'm sure the first thing she would say is, "Oh, you made the best brisket of my life." It wasn't me so much as the brisket itself, which was from DeBraga, from whom you can these days order online and they deliver it to your door overnight. It's pretty expensive. I haven't looked lately, but a whole brisket is what I recommend. And that's hard to find. I know you have a butcher, Marshall, so if you wanted it, he would provide that to you. But not everybody can, ask a butcher for this, or that they're capable. So most people these days don't even want a whole brisket. What they buy is what the butchers call first cut, which of course makes it sound like it's better than the second cut, or which I call deckle, or which could also be called point. There are several names for it, but the flat cut is the one that has the lesser amount of fat, and very, very tragically, mostly they're trimmed way too close, not even leaving on it a natural, layer of fat to keep it moistened and juicy when it cooks. Anyway, so I don't make that very often. I never make that. I only make a brisket if I can buy the whole brisket, and with all the fat. The fat gets trimmed off at the end. And why do Jews eat brisket for New Year? The same reason they eat brisket for Passover, with a little added reason for Passover, in that you're not supposed to eat roasted meat on Passover. You're not supposed to eat, braised meat. I don't know that, what the rabbis will tell you about that. That probably could do a whole day on that. Anyway, because meat, when you came to this country as an immigrant, the ability to eat meat was a huge, huge thing. In the old country, maybe you got meat on a celebration day, or, around slaughter time, of course, you'd probably get a little meat. But you didn't get much meat. And that, by the way, it doesn't matter what old country you come from, whether it was Italy, Eastern Europe, Russia, wherever. It was poor. And it was also, meat was a very precious thing, always has been. So in ancient times, the meat was, slaughtering a sacrificial lamb, literally sacrificial lamb. So you didn't waste the meat, you ate it. Anyway, back to brisket. So you're an immigrant from Eastern Europe. This is one of the cuts of meat that you can eat according to the kosher laws. Because if you're kosher, you can only eat the four quarters of the cow, not the hind quarters. So the best piece of kosher meat is, and I'm sure that people who keep kosher will tell you this, is ribs. You can have a rib roast, you can have rib steaks. That's the best, most tender cut of meat that is kosher. But you also have, and then forward from the ribs, you have chuck. We all love chuck. And then there's neck. When I was a kid, my mother would send me for ground meat. She would say, 1 pound neck and tenderloin was mixed together. The tenderloin was not at all tenderloin. It was hanger steak, what we now call hanger steak. In those days, was referred to sometimes as butcher's tenderloin because it was a piece of meat that the butcher, who knew it was a good piece of meat, took home for his family. So then you've got the meat that's below, so to speak. I mean, the chuck is the shoulder. And you've got first brisket, and then plate, P-L-A-T-E. And plate, which is below the ribs, is, I guess you'd have to say, equivalent to bacon on a pig. However, no kosher person would say that, but that's what it is. It's this fatty, streaky piece of meat, which has been made into pastrami. I just read an article on the internet by some woman with an Irish name saying, why do Jews eat brisket on Rosh Hashanah? And she mentioned that brisket is used to make pastrami. No, it is not. People do make pastrami out of brisket, but it's not the traditional cut. What makes pastrami is that it is dry cured with a mix of spices and heavy on the coriander seed, and it is smoked. And it should be extremely fatty meat because it loses a lot in the process. And it's still juicy. Well, it should be anyway. So brisket became, because it's not that fatty plate meat, which had to be treated, to make it into pastrami or do something like that. But the brisket actually was a solid muscle. So you could serve that in a Jewish household. It served a lot of people, and it was meat. So in the old country, you didn't get it. Now you could supersize it, so to speak. And brisket became a feature of many holiday meals in Jewish households. It also evolved over years into, well, sort of whatever is of the day. Because I read the other day a recipe for brisket that includes Thai fish sauce. So that's very of the moment, I think. In my grandmother Rosie's moment, it was ketchup. A lot of Jews, kosher Jews, my grandmother did not keep kosher, but she definitely cooked a lot of Jewishy things. She was born in Brooklyn. Her parents were born in, well, debatable where they were born. In any case, well, her mother was born in Bialystok. That I know. That's Poland. So she used ketchup to make her brisket. This was a very common thing because Heinz tomato ketchup, besides having the sweet and sour flavor profile that is a very ancient Jewish, really a very, not only Ashkenazi Jewish, but also Mediterranean Jewish, Sephardic Jewish, taste. In fact, just yesterday, my friend Roseanne was telling me that this all dates back to some Jewish Persian precedent. I have to look this up. But anyway, the sweet-sour taste was already a very loved flavor profile. Tomatoes were introduced into Europe in the, probably around the end of the 1500s, 1600s. And so they were already part of the diet of Eastern European Jews, and they used them a lot. And so you end up with this sweet and sour profile, and then in 1926, I think it was, I got to look that up in my own book. This is all, by the way, in Jewish home cooking. The Heinz Company, because by the 20s, Jews were a big demographic, certainly in New York. By the mid 20th century, one in four New Yorkers were Jews. I think it's now one in seven. In any case, Heinz decided to make it known that their product was kosher and abide by the Jewish dietary laws, and they enlisted help from the Orthodox Union, which is a supervisory organization to this day, and they came up with a symbol, an O with a U inside it, for Orthodox Union. And if that symbol was on the product, it meant, to those who knew, that the product was kosher. So all of a sudden, we had a mainstream American product, Heinz ketchup, kosher in the 20s, and I know that Heinz encouraged the Jewish community to use ketchup in this way. You know, they had articles in the Forwards and other Jewish publications. And I have a huge collection of recipe pamphlets that I should look through. I bet you I have some Heinz ones. But in any case, it took over in the kosher community. So my grandmother, that was of her day. My father was born in 1923. By the end of the 20s, my grandmother was a mother, and she had to cook every day because my grandfather was very demanding about food. In fact, I'm sure it was his encouragement to use the Heinz ketchup. But my grandmother made her brisket with Heinz ketchup. My mother, in her day, in the 50s, or maybe this was already 1960-ish, decided that Harvey's Bristol cream was an appropriate ingredient to make a brisket. And we suffered through the Harvey's Bristol cream era until my mother finally went back to my grandmother's method, which was nothing except onions, if you want some carrots, a couple bay leaves, you could rub with garlic if you really have to, and that's it. And So I don't know. I've written this recipe so many times, I do not want to repeat it. There is actually a real recipe for this in at least two of my books, and probably on the Internet. I keep finding my own stuff on the Internet. My rule here is you need about whatever the brisket weighs, and it's going to weigh a lot if you get a whole brisket, use almost, let's say, a third of the weight in onions, sliced on the bottom of a roasting pan. I do put a couple of bay leaves on top of the onions. I put the roast on top of that. I put a foil over the whole thing, and I stick it in the oven for hours and hours. After about 3 hours, you usually have a beautifully tender piece of meat, but not quite, but almost. At that point, I chill it. I skim all the fat. You can take all the fat that's between the deckel or the point cut on the top and the flat cut on the bottom. You can take that all off now. And I usually do this, I mean, it's superb, right out of the oven when it's just tender. But I also, you know, I know that it's not practical. Most people have to do it ahead or even a day ahead, and I don't mind doing it a day ahead. I refrigerate it, skim off the fat from the onions, which have now reduced into a mush. I don't puree my I love it just the way it is. For Rosh Hashanah, we can have it with kasha. Don't even need the pasta, the farfel, the butterflies. Just kasha and the onions on top of the kasha. I'm tasting it right now. Anyway, that's our New Year's dish, and I'm not making it because it's too big an investment for, I don't even know how many, maybe it will be four people for New Year. But I already have succumbed to apples. Now, there's a sign of fall. The first apples are coming. You have apples, I'm sure, right?
Yes, apples. Apples are arriving, and that is a nice sign of fall, and that is.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites. In fact, I deprived myself of apples last fall because I was on keto. Nowadays, I'm eating a more balanced diet, and I crave fruit. So I bought apples, and I couldn't resist. I actually cooked with an apple yesterday, but I'll tell you about that in a second. But I've decided that apples are the most reliable fruit. Even when an apple doesn't have enormous flavor or aroma, at least it's crisp and juicy. And I've had such bad experience with nectarines and peaches this summer. I'm happy to see them go. And I had a laugh and then cringe when I saw that local prune plums, were $8.99 a pound at the farmer's market.
Oh, wow.
So I passed on that. But I usually make applesauce this time of the year because it's the intersection of Italian prune plums and apples. And before the prune plums disappear, which could be in a few weeks, I would do 1 pound of the prune plums, which I pit. Don't do anything. You just have them and pit them. Throw them in a pot. With 3 pounds of apples. For applesauce, they don't have to be perfect apples. I don't peel my apples. I just core them and chunk them up and throw them in the pot. And then you could put in, if you don't have a really good heavy-bottomed pot, and I suggest you do have one, like enamel cast iron is good for this because it's nice and heavy. You start it out on low heat with literally a few tablespoons of water. And as soon as you start getting some mush, some soft apples on the bottom, you can turn it. But keep it covered, and as it moisture collects, you can raise the heat a little bit now, a little bit more, and eventually could take 15, 20 minutes minimum even. It depends on how many apples. Well, we said 3 pounds and a pound of prune plum. This is going to take at least 20 minutes to a half hour. And I take my potato masher and I mash it all up And then I put it through, and by the way, you want to cook them until they're easily mashed up. That's sort of how I judge if they're done. And then I put it through the food mill. Now, I happen to have a food mill. We talked about that a few weeks ago about tomato sauce. I do use my food mill a lot, and it has three blades. In this case, I would use the medium or even the coarse blade. You want the apple skin is going to give a nice color, and the plums are going to give a nice color. You're really going to love the color. I happen to have my grandmother's, we used to call it a China cap. You know, it's a conical sieve. It has a metal stand that it goes on and a wooden pestle. And if I want my applesauce to have the same texture as my grandmother's, Elsie's, not the one who mother came from, Bialystok, but my other grandmother was born in Brooklyn, too. I use that, and I think I will use that this year because I have it hanging to look at it. I should use it. So a lot of things in fall. Apples. I don't know what made me think I was going to like this, and I only sort of did, marginally. But do you know what a Dutch baby is?
No.
Dutch baby is a baked pancake. It has many, many variations. The most basic Dutch baby, but you know what it is? It's a cross between Yorkshire pudding and a popover. It's Yorkshire pudding. It is sort of Yorkshire pudding. If I used the fat from roasting, making a roast, and I baked this Dutch baby, it would be Yorkshire pudding. So it's a batter of eggs in not in Jewish terms, by the way. My proportions always are 3 eggs, a half a cup of flour, a half a cup of milk. If it's going to be savory, no sugar, but maybe as much as 3/4 teaspoon of salt, and you beat that all together or make it in the blender, let it sit for a while. It's better if it rests. And then you put it in a very, very heavily buttered, very hot pan. I use my 10-inch cast iron pan for that. And you get this big, puffy pancake thing. Well, I've been wanting to make an apple Dutch baby, and now I had the apple. I have a nice big apple, Mutsu apple, which is a good pie apple, by the way. They're big green apples. They're usually quite flavorful. The one that I had was not all that flavorful. But anyway, I made it. Sautéed I cored and peeled the apple, sliced it into my cast iron pan with 2 tablespoons of butter, sautéed it until it got the tiniest bit of color on it, the apples. I think maybe next time, if I did this again, I would cook the apples a little further, only to get a little bit more caramelization. And then I pour in my batter. In this case, I had sugar in the batter. But let me say, I also added an extra egg on the advice of a friend, and that was a mistake. 4 eggs made too puddingy a pancake. Some people, you know what? Have you ever had clafouti? It was sort of clafouti-ish, and it's not a texture I love, but other people do. That's why there's a thing about clafouti, which is his French. It's too starchy for me. But anyway, so I would do 3 eggs, my classic one, 3 eggs, and that's it. So after, you know, it bakes for 20 minutes, it's all puffed up at 450 degrees, it's all puffed up, and I sprinkled it with some powdered sugar, and a thing with these Dutch babies is to squeeze on some lemon juice and then sprinkle on the confectioner's sugar, and you get a nice glazy thing going. But I didn't want to do all that. I don't know. I wanted to taste the apples because it was all about the apples for me. So another thing, squash. I mean, yes, you can buy squash all year, but now is the time to eat squash. For some reason, I don't eat squash in the middle of the summer unless I'm in Italy, because on Cecilia's farm, they have so much squash coming up, they have to do something with it. And the something is often grilling it and then marinating it with garlic and parsley or mint, olive oil, a little drizzle here or there of vinegar. I love doing it even, but I wait until the fall to do that, because standing in front of the grill on top of the stove even is too much in August. But anyway, the thing I did already, because I couldn't wait, was I made, and this is a recipe, by the way, that's in Arthur Schwartz's, no, it's called, what's that book called? The Southern Italian Table. So it's squash and sausage and with rosemary, and the mixture can be used either on pasta, which is what I usually do. I usually do it on rigatoni or some other big tubular pasta, even pacchetti. If you do you know what pacchetti are?
No.
Ah, okay. You should by now. I'm going to scold you because I was the first person in America to talk about pacchetti back in the 90s. And in fact, it didn't exist in America. I had to bring mine home from Italy. Schiaffone is the other name for this largest of all tubular pastas. And I literally brought pounds back with me. Nowadays, you can buy them even in a supermarket. Pacchetti, P-A-C-C-H-E-R-I, and for those who love knowing about these things, the word is related to patch, like in Yiddish, where you to slap. Your grandmother would threaten you with a patch and tuchus. I'm going to slap your tuchus if you don't behave. Well, patch and pacchetti are related words. There was an Austrian element to Neapolitan dialect, but in Italian they're called schiaffoni. Anyway, very large tubes. So how I make this is, now I use a nice coarse sausage, which I've now decided is not quite fatty enough, because my butcher, you know, he makes them and his customers don't want as fatty a sausage as I would like. So I'm going to follow my original recipe, which was to add a little bit of pancetta for a little extra fat. But two links of sausage cut out of the skin, out of the casing. And I would say an ounce, maybe even two, depending on your sausage, an ounce or 2 ounces of diced pancetta. Now, I mean, really, an ounce should be enough. And a glug of olive oil to get it all started, and put it over medium-low heat, and chop up the sausage with the side of your spoon as it's cooking, and then you can increase the heat as you get a little bit more fat in the pan, and then add a half of a chopped onion. When I say a half, you know, most people buy bigger onions than they should. I buy small onions just for this kind of case. And so anyway, about, let's say, a half to three quarters of a cup of chopped onion. And then keep going. Keep sauteing. Onion will wilt a little bit. I then add rosemary. Now, let me just say, the other day when I made this, I forgot to put the rosemary in, and all I had was dried rosemary, my own dried rosemary, meaning I bought rosemary and I'd let it dry because I couldn't use it all. But it's perfectly good rosemary. And then I would add the dried rosemary at this point, too. But in fact, I forgot to add it, and I added it at the end, and it ended up to be pretty good. I had to crush the dried rosemary with my fingers into a real crumble. But anyway, so that's, and now you have rosemary in there. The sausage, of course, is seasoned with salt and pepper, so you don't need that. Now, when everything is the sausage has lost all its raw color, you can add your squash. I use pretty, because it's easy, I use just the neck portion of about a 2-pound squash. And that neck portion, peeled and cubed, and I would say you want your cubes no bigger than an inch cube. They don't have to be too small. That should provide you with 4 to 5 cups of cubed squash. Now, if you go into the supermarket, you're going to see already cubed squash, and if that's what you want to do, you need 4 to 5 cups of cubed squash. I don't know what that is in the package, how many packages that is, but I actually enjoy chopping, cutting, dicing, peeling. Nah, I'm not so crazy about peeling winter squash, but I do it. How I do it? Oh, people ask, how do you do that? Well, these days, I cut the reason I'm saying just the neck portion of the squash is because the other portion has all the seeds in it. You got to scoop it out. Da, 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 da. It's curved. It's a little harder to deal with. So this one, if it's peeled, I cut them into 1-inch-ish, 3/4-inch, 1-inch slices, and then I can peel each slice, and it works very well, and it goes quickly. Hmm. So then I put that in the pot with just enough water to cover everything, just enough. And I have measured this hundreds of times, probably. 2 cups of water is what you need. I do it in a cast iron pot, even a saucepan, like a 2.5-3-quart saucepan. 2 cups of water. Simmer it. Salt and freshly ground pepper. If you like hot pepper, this is the time to add some hot pepper. Simmer it for about 15, 20 minutes at least, until the squash is really soft enough to squash it with your wooden spoon against the side of the pot. I just want to be very rustic and just squash my squash with the spoon. If you want to use a potato masher, that works too. But I don't want it too mashed, because I do want some pieces left in my condimento. That's the dressing for pasta. That's going to make enough, by the way, to dress a pound of pasta.
Well, we have to squash the show.
I'm sorry, did you just make a joke?
Well, yeah, we're at the end of the time for the show.
No, that I know.
Yeah. That wasn't a joke. It was.
I haven't been in radio for 40 years.
I know. Yeah, I've actually
good at timing.
I'm going to actually try that last thing that you mentioned. I'm going to actually try that.
Oh yeah, listen. You have my book. It's in there if you want to follow the recipe.
Right.
But I just said I know that I had a laugh about this 2 cups of water the other day because I was making it in a different pot than I used to make it in for years and years. I had to finally retire that pot. It was 40 years old. But anyway, I'm in a new pot and I'm thinking, oh, is it still going to be 2 cups of water? And sure enough, it was 2 cups of water.
All right.
Well,
welcome to fall.
You don't understand, when somebody who writes recipes, as I do, makes his own recipe to the letter and it works, we're very happy.
Hey, whenever I make anything and it works, I'm happy. So I do understand.
All right. Well, I should say Lashana Tova. It starts next. It starts this Sunday, Jewish New Year.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio, and of course robinhoodradio.com on the web.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, Hillsdale Home Chef. More information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.